You're listening to episode 21 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on talentopoly.com each week. I'm your host, Jared Brown, and I'm joined by
Brandon Corbin.
Hey, Brandon, how's it going?
It's going super. How are you?
Good. We're doing a little, bit later this time, but
we're a little sleepier.
I've got my beer, so all is well. The beer podcast I've been doing every other week has been going well, and yesterday actually, we went to the Fountain Square Brewery Company, which hasn't quite opened yet, and we were interviewing the one of the founders of the brewery, which was really cool, and I picked up a growler of their amber ale and brought that home. So I've got a huge growler of their ale, and I'm working my way through that tonight.
Is it good?
It is good. It's on the lighter side, which I like, a more of like a wheat ale type of beer. You know, and it's not a porter, it's not a stout. The amber is a nice lighter beer, and they did a good job with it.
Good. That's fantastic. I am extremely happy for you.
Awesome.
Me, I'm having the cellar number 8 again, but this time I went with the red wine. And what that basically means is all of the shit wine that they have left over, they just combine it into a bucket and scoop it in, and they give it a generic name. And it's pretty bad.
Okay.
But that's okay.
So they don't even call it a blend at that point.
No. It's just red wine. It's just red wine, and it's probably got like 8 different variations in it.
Killer. All right, well, in this podcast, because we're at the end of the year, I dug up some links here that have been posted recently on the site. Some, you know, best of 2011 or what I learned in 2011 type links. So I'm looking forward to kind of digging into some of this stuff. And there were quite a few things that we had seen on Talentopoly through the months. And then there were things that kind of surprised me that had slipped through the cracks and I hadn't seen before.
Really? You mean there's news that happens that doesn't end up on Talentopoly?
Very little, but there was some.
Now, are any of these links covered not found? They all are found now. Are you talking about the links, or are you just talking about in general?
I mean, like, especially, we'll get into it here, with the jQuery plugins. Things in there, and that's a big article, but there were some things in there I had never seen before. But looks super useful.
Yes, I agree with that completely.
Excellent. I'm glad you agree with
I agree completely with you, Jared.
I agree that you have not seen that ever before.
I concur. I'm actually looking at one right now, which is their which was an infield labels jQuery plugin. And
ooh, yes, I did see that.
I like them. I like them a lot because it's a copy of what Apple does on their shopping cart checkout flow. But man, there's still a problem, even though when I type, it's like, oh, I type Brandon, and then I'm like, shit, was that a first name or a full name?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's still a downside to it. It definitely makes the interface look so much cleaner, but I think from user, anyway, sorry, sidetrack.
No, that's a really good point. I kind of wonder what the solution is to that.
I just don't. The only thing I can think is that what you do is you have the labels look really good but float right. And so, you know, I'm looking at the sample comment form, right? They always go full width. And so Brandon Corbin does not fill up that much space. So you could have the thing on the right side inside of the label, and it wouldn't even probably have to fade away.
It's very true. I like that.
Anyway.
Okay. Before we jump into our articles, I thought it might be fun to try our hand at a couple of predictions for next year. And I know this is kind of like on the spot predictions, but
yeah,
what's
yeah.
the first, like, just shoot something that comes to mind that you think
there's going to be a cloud clusterfuck. And meaning that all of these websites and web apps and everything are being built on all these various cloud services, and the apps are going to get extremely unreliable. Because while maybe Mongo HQ is working fine, you know, Amazon has a bump, boom. So all of a sudden, every cloud service that we integrate into our application is now a new point of failure that we don't have control of.
Right. That's a good point. And
I'm finding that out because I started building everything that way.
Mm-hmm. Have you been on Heroku?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So really what it came down to is even just like the small, YQL to do location lookup, right? You know, all of these small little things that can cause, you know, various problems. Or Mongo, I was on my Mongo HQ database actually got affected and it was down for 30 minutes. Oh. And it's kind of like, well, there's not a damn thing that I can do about that.
Exactly.
Except for try to write, okay, well, now what I need to do is I need to have, you know, whatever. It's going to render all this stuff out, so in case that the database is down. So probably because it's happening and I'm finding all these problems, the application itself will be better off for it. But that's my prediction, is that there's going to be a whole lot of people going, oh, my God, I can't believe that that went down and we're now on a standstill for the next 2.5 hours.
All right, I got a prediction related to that. I predict that in 2012, we will rely even more heavily on cloud platforms and APIs and external services.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt that more and more people are going to be using them.
Yeah.
And that's why I think the cloud Armageddon. Well, hell, it's just like when Amazon went down that one time and brought down, you know, Twitter, Tumblr, where I forget, was it S3 that went out or something?
Yep. Yeah, Talentopoly has had its fair share of AWS-caused outages.
Yeah.
And all you do is, you know, read the blog post going up about how it's so bad. You know, and I think every time it happens, those cloud providers, they really buckle down and try to figure out newer ways to increase get to 5.9s. And I think cloud can get to 5.9s, just like your data center supposedly is at 5.9s. I think you're going to get there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we're going to get there, but I do think there's going to be the 2012 will be the all of the pain that happens to get us to 2013, where we're, you know, stable and everything is now completely enterprise ready.
Right. Well, and also the cloud should be more stable because it's more failover, featured. So you can very easily just cluster things or easily fail over it and spin up a new instance of something. The bigger outages, the problems have happened where the entire frickin' Virginia data center for AWS goes down.
Yeah.
And then if you weren't already cross-regional, where you weren't load balancing between regions, well, then you're screwed. And most people aren't doing that yet. I think that brings up a good point. These cloud platforms need to make it a lot easier, just baked in and super simple for you to just get to that level where you're balancing between different, maybe even different cloud platforms. You know, some people are doing that. Apple's doing that. They're using their own data center in North Carolina. They're also using the Microsoft Azure platform. Netflix is using regional, you know, they use all the regional data centers for AWS. And
did you look at that Netflix PowerPoint presentation?
No, which one?
That was like 60 slides about their architecture. And it's insane. And I'll try to see if I can dig up what that link was.
Sure.
But it was amazing. And going through all the architecture that they use Amazon for all the various stuff. But it was like, holy shit. And here's all the reasons why, you know, we didn't want to just do it all of ourselves. And
right.
Very cool. Very cool.
No, totally. All right. Let's jump into some articles here.
All right.
First article tonight is titled What I Learned About the Web in 2011. And this was posted by Paul Giberson. This is on A List Apart, and it looks like what they did is go around and get little snippets, little quote from a bunch of different people, developers and designers, about things that they learned this year. And I really like this format of just, you know, this cross-section of the industry and the design and developer industry of what they were, you know, what they think were big pieces that happened in 2011. So some of the...
Sorry.
Oh, no, and just feel free to interrupt me.
too long, didn't read.
Well, let's go over a couple of these. Let's just randomly move around here. So Dan Cederholm, founder of Simple Bits, Dribbble, he says that the recent advances seem overwhelming to keep up with. HTML5, CSS3, responsive web design, mobile, web fonts, grids. And he's learning to just take it one step at a time and focus on incrementally learning these things and folding them into his projects versus trying to take them all on at once.
Sure.
And I bet a lot of people would echo that sentiment about how much is going on. All right, go ahead and just what random ones.
The apps redefining the web. This is obviously an interesting one. But it's true. He goes to the point of saying, you know, like, let's take Instagram. It's one of the most popular services on the web. And the entire experience is controlled not by some HTML pages, but rather an iPhone app. And it really is interesting to see that how – but I can't say that the web is dead like everybody else is saying when it comes to, you know, it's all apps. Because, like, I sit back and I read this. I'm like, oh, my God. And, you know, I finally need to sit down and really learn how to develop on the iPhone. By the time I get good at it, though, I'm convinced that Apple won't have their hands on the market like they do right now.
Right.
And so I don't know. So that's my problem with it.
HTML5 apps could take over by then.
Yes, I do. I think that seems to make more sense to me because it's, you know, we're just going to have more and more proliferation of different mobile devices. And as long as we all can agree on the HTML5, hopefully open up some of the APIs for like the camera and file browsing, then I think it wins. But I don't know. It's definitely true, though, that 2011 was the year of the apps, and 2012 will probably be as well.
Well, I'll bet more people are putting data in via the mobile, or at least it's probably fairly close, the mobile Facebook app versus Facebook.com. Because I saw some stuff recently. The mobile Facebook app is the most used app on Android, even more used than just Google search.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's the most common task performed on the Android platform is to load up the Facebook app and interact with Facebook. Yeah.
But, you know, but really, I mean, hell, most of that app is just done in HTML5 anyway.
Right. Yeah, and they have the touch.facebook.com.
Mm-hmm.
The iOS one, I think, is all truly iOS, but I haven't seen the Android one.
No, even the iOS one is, because if you'll notice, all of a sudden you'll start having different design elements within the list view, and you never did an update. So I'm pretty sure that list view is actually being rendered as HTML within, you know, a viewport.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It seems pretty high quality. I wouldn't think that'd be a good experience, but I never noticed.
Yeah, yeah. Patrick and I both, we were like, wait a minute, what the hell? And he's like, did you upgrade? I'm like, no. But it is, you can go through. And now I have to say that the iPhone app is pretty buggy. The one that I've got where it's constantly trying to refresh itself, and it's like it just sits there and it like loads and refreshes, and I can't follow anything. But yeah, whatever.
So Instagram, Path, and Oink are really good examples of websites that are popular but are really just read-only formats.
Yeah.
And all the data is being put in through apps, which also not that surprising because these mobile apps have GPS, they have cameras built in. They're a great device for creating content and putting it in. And then your large screen is a great device for consuming content. So it kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the next article. The 50 most useful jQuery plugins from 2011, posted by Julian Weaver.
Man, this thing is insane. I mean, this is truly like an insane list of some amazing, amazing jQuery plugins. Which ones caught your attention?
Well, I kind of laughed when I saw recurly.js on there because it keeps coming up in our podcast.
Yeah, yeah. No, I told you I've been using Stripe, and I ended up going with Stripe for the business that I'm building right now.
I really like what Stripe's doing. If I needed a super lightweight, you know, I need to put it in the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
Type of way, you know, or a checkout system, I think I'd go with Recurly.
But they still don't. So on that checkout, on the credit card form, you do not have to be on an secure connection, correct?
I did look at that because I knew this was going to come up.
Yeah.
And it is using signatures. It is generating signatures, and then it can validate that on the server side to know that the data has not been tampered with.
I want to test this out because I know that if I could get a JavaScript file on a page that's insecure, no, I could do it anyway.
It's using HMAC digital signatures.
Interesting.
So they've got it. If you click on documentation and then signatures, it's one of the main sections, and you can read about how they do the unencrypted verification message, the private key, and the resulting signature. So it is using public private key similar to what SSL is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, so that one's pretty cool. The informed labels, like we talked about, which I'm still not convinced on. There's one called syphilis.
Is that how it is? It's Sisyphus.
Oh, syphilis. And
syphilis.
And this one's kind of interesting, though, because it gives you client-side drafts. Mm-hmm. So when your visitor is filling out the forms, accidentally swipes back on Google Chrome on my friggin' mouse. Yes. Like, happens all the damn time. So that could be a really cool one to add.
What about ideal forms?
You know, I don't care for the way it looks.
Yeah, I don't. Is that really just it? It's just the styling?
Well, no, because I didn't look at this one, but it seems like a lot of times you have these frameworks that do both kind of validation, and then they also try to make things look spiffy and cool. And it's kind of like, the forms aren't cool enough to warrant me wanting to install all of that versus, you know, some other validation framework. Whatever. It's ugly. I don't like it.
Yeah, agreed. I don't even know if it does validate.
There's the credit card format validation, which is cool. And when you see the website, you're like, damn, that's an awesome credit card look. I mean, it looks really, really good in this mock-up. Then you actually go look at the demo and it looks like shit. It's like 80% of this. And it was like, I designed the screenshot in Photoshop. And then I was like, oh, I got to figure out how to do that on the web.
Excellent. What about the motion capture?
Yeah. What do you think of this one? Awesome. Motion capture.
Yeah. Well, the biggest problem people have with captures now is they can't read them anymore.
Yep.
You know, they've gotten so obfuscated that the humans fail the test. So doing the motion capture thing, I think that makes a lot of sense. That's something people will get used to, and a lot of people have touchscreen devices or the Magic Trackpad or, you know, their laptop trackpad. If you can use your mouse too, but
yeah. Well, I think there's a disability problem with them. So I went through and I tried to if you do it real quick, you can get it and you can be super sloppy.
Right.
But if you go slow and you're sloppy, you're not going to pass. So okay. I do think there's you know, people with disabilities who have a hard time controlling the mouse as much as that piece I think might be a problem, but I think it's ingenious. Right. And, you know, maybe this implementation isn't the best way of doing it, but it's still, I really do think that finally someone might have come up with a better way to do captures.
There needs to be a better way. It's time for a better way. Whether it's like, here's 9 photos, pick the one that's a dinosaur. Yeah. Like motion capture, whatever it is, I think we need to start experimenting with other stuff.
I mean, we can keep going. There's just so many on here
that
are
on here that you just had not ever seen before that kind of blew your mind.
You know, that capture one really, really did. You know, then they've got like a lot of gallery and slide things. Most of the things you've seen,
right?
They had the reveal. Which is, it looks like it's the one that is directly pulled from Zurb's foundation. Mm. That's pretty cool. The overscroll, which is something I am going to look at. That's, you know, gives you that kind of, you know, it takes overflow DOM elements and makes them draggable within, you know, the touch.
Or iOS style.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Overscrolling.
So I'll probably end up using that.
Actually, I would use that on the Talentopoly chat room in the beginning.
That's what you were using?
I was.
Oh, and?
Let's see, what were the problems with it? Because I did go back to just using a native scroll bar. And yeah. One of the reasons that I wanted the overscroll was I did not want to take up that extra little width for the permanent scroll bar on the mm-hmm. side there. You know, nowadays, who wants to do that anymore? So, but I realized that you can style in WebKit, you can style the scroll bar. And you can basically create that same disappearing scroll bar, you know, with some JavaScript and CSS and get the same thing. Or if you just use a new Chrome or a new Safari on Lion, you just get it anyway. And
yeah.
So the overscroll thing was just a neat effect that I didn't need anymore. And it wasn't, you know, the lack of pervasive browser support, it did act a little differently in Firefox than it did in Chrome and that sort of thing. So I was like, you know, I don't really need it that badly. Scroll bar is a tough thing to mess with.
Sure.
Because now you're outside of the native experience. You really got to question when you're doing that, why am I not letting the browser take care of this? This is what it's good at.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, there's 50 really, really good JavaScript plugins, and it's definitely worth checking out.
Yep. And some good font stuff in there, too, if you're doing lettering and fonts.
Oh, so speaking of that, I think we talked about the Pictos font icons.
Yep.
I bought it.
Excellent.
I bought it and I love it. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't think I'm, because I'm sitting there and I'm working on this app and I start building out my sprite and I'm like, oh, I need this icon, this icon, this icon. Oh, I need it in 24. I need it in 16. Oh shit. Now I need them in black and I need them in white, you know? And it was like, this is ridiculous. And sure shit, went to Pictos and boom, there we go. It's a P, you know, it's a capital S. It's like, this is awesome.
It is. It's revolutionary. Our next article is Best Resources in iOS Development as of December 12th, 2011. That's actually in the title. Posted by Phil Oliver. All right. What are some of the ones that we've got here?
Yeah.
We're not really, you don't really do iOS development, right?
I don't. I mean, you know what I do like though? No, I don't do iOS development, but I do like seeing that all these like open libraries are starting to come out and people are, you know, starting to share them and make it, you know, easier for people to start building and hopefully not having to do a lot of the low level shit that's kind of required to do iOS devices.
I was surprised. I've been using the Path 2 app and I know it's done some cool user interface things that are kind of unique. You know, nobody had really done that before. And then looking at this list, I started to realize that it really is being noticed by other iOS devs, and they're doing stuff that people want to copy. Like have you played with the Path 2 app?
I haven't yet. I had an account, and I keep getting notifications now that people are starting to follow me, but I've yet to use it with the new version.
It's interesting. It's kind of morphed into basically Facebook from what I've
heard. Yeah, I'm antisocial anyway. And it's like, unless I can post to it from Twitter, it's probably not going to get updated by me.
I don't update it really. But I've gone in there and you tap a button, the menu button is in the bottom left, this little icon. And as soon as you tap on that sucker, it's, you know, it's all the different things you can do. Like say you're going to sleep or say you're waking up, you want to post a link, you want to do a text status update, you want to post an image, you want to post your location. Those are all different things you can post. And so you click that icon. And then this nice little animation flings those icons out in a semicircle around it. And okay. So I guess that's something that people are wanting to copy. And now they have this. The first thing in this article here is a library for creating an animated curved menu, like in Path 2. So if that's something you want to do, here's the library to do it. And that's pretty cool. They have a library to allow any Objective-C object to easily be saved to a plist. I could see that as being quite useful. New networking framework. They have another one, roundup of Path 2 UE-inspired open source iOS libraries and analysis on them. So there's a whole roundup just for Path 2 UE stuff. How to make realistic water ripples with Cocos 2D. That sounds awesome. I mean, pretty sure you can just turn that into an app and sell that. Those sometimes do pretty well, actually. Just tap on it and do ripples and whatnot.
Look,
you know, maybe we're past that point. I haven't kept up on iOS apps as much, but there were some apps as of just even a year ago that basically did just that, and they would sell pretty decently.
That's embarrassing.
Well, it's all about party demo. You know, the whole, like, standing around at the cocktail party or
whatever, yeah,
with your friends, like, hey, look at this. Or, you know, like, the pretend you drink a beer, and as you tilt your iPhone, the beer drains
it's
out of it.
It's like that insurance commercial.
Exactly. Yeah, where it's, like, the end of the day or something.
Mm-hmm.
They get their mustache apps out. You could work for a year, make the most complex app, and then that dude who created the mustache app is going to outsell you 100 times over.
My friend built a mousetrap app. And it has a piece of cheese on it, and you have to drag the cheese off very slowly. If you go too fast, you're going to get snapped, and then you try to see how many times you can do it.
Amazing.
That's it.
And he sells it, or is he giving it away?
Yeah, no, he sells it for like $1.99. And you know what, though? What's so funny is it's so simple that it's actually kind of entertaining. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll support him for it. And where is it? Maybe I have it on my iPad, but it's cheese something. I don't remember. I should probably find it and give him props to all of the 100,000 listeners of Talonopoly Podcast. Don't judge.
While you're doing that, I'm going to talk about this cool library for easily adding an iCloud photo gallery to your app. So you, with iOS 5 library, or with this iOS 5 library, you can have a iCloud images integrated into your app, which is interesting.
Do they not make that available easily in the API?
I don't know.
Apparently not easy enough.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Maybe this is a wrapper on that. So,
interesting.
That photo stream has been really great. I'm enjoying it.
I've turned it off.
Really?
Because I can't delete the damn photos.
Well, actually, in the new update, you will be able to.
Well, good. When I can delete them, then I will. Because otherwise, I'm not going to be taking some of the photos that I take and have them forever in my fucking photo stream.
They're not. They're only for 30 days.
Since when?
Since always. Photo stream deletes itself. It's just a temporary way of moving your photos between your devices.
Yeah. But I still don't want them there for 30 days.
Okay.
I've got photos that I take that I definitely don't want to be up on the internet.
Right. Although it is not on like a website or anything.
No, of course not. It's just see, again, we're old enough to know that whatever you put up on the internet very well can get all over the fucking internet if you're not careful.
You do have your tinfoil hat on right now too, right?
wait, no. No, but the fact of the matter is, if I send a text message to my wife of a picture of my belly button.
Right. Some hackers.
At the moment that I let go of that image, I lose all control of it.
Right. I can understand.
That's what I'm saying, is that I don't care if it can be completely secure. Hell, everybody thought their password was secure being on Sony, the PlayStation Network.
Did they really?
I think so. I mean, obviously enough that they put their credit card information. Right. But so I don't need a picture of my balls floating around on the internet. And so, and not even that, just stupid things.
Go far enough to question whatever. Why does a picture of your balls need to exist at all?
Because I can do it with this front-facing camera.
Oh, God.
No. But again, so I've been leery about it. But if they can make it so I can just click it and delete it from there, then I'm golden, and I will absolutely use it. Because I did like it. I did like having, hey, look, I took it here. Boom, it's on my iPad.
Yeah.
Love it. Except for that one feature. Just killed it for me.
I use it because I'm taking photos on the iPhone. And I consider, unless I put photos up in my Flickr account, which I pay for the pro account, so I have unlimited size on my photos, unlimited number of them, and all the rest of that. So I just put all of our photos and our videos into Flickr. So that way I know I will have them forever. So, my iPhone may get formatted or lost or whatever the case may be. That's a temporary place to store my photos.
Yeah.
If I print photos out or I put them on a CD or on an external hard drive, all temporary places. All those things will at one point be destroyed, but the cloud will still be there, hopefully. It'll take nuclear warfare to take down the multiple Flickr data centers and destroy all my images.
So let me ask you, let me put a challenge out there for you. I've got a growing continually library of 32 gigs worth of photos.
Uh-huh.
What do I do?
I would put them on Flickr.
And so the pro account can, there's no bandwidth limit?
Absolutely not. It's the best deal anywhere. For $2 a month, you put all your photos and video, not compressed, the full size of these things, up on Flickr.
And is there a good iPhoto interface at all?
So here's the deal. This is what I love now. I'm in Nirvana now. I have my iPhone. I'm taking photos and videos on there. PhotoStream, I wish it did videos, but it only syncs those photos down to my Lion-powered iPhoto computer. So I open up iPhoto when I get back from, let's say, a vacation. I've taken a whole week's worth of these photos. So I open up an iPhoto and it has the events. All of my photos are organized into events from the photo stream. And it knows this because of location and the I took a photo every couple of hours or whatever. Those were all part of the same trip. So it puts it all in that same trip. Then I've tied in, it has Flickr integration built in. So I just logged into that. And then I can right mouse click on that event. And I can say, create a set in Flickr and sync it up to that set. And boom, all my photos are now in Flickr with the correct set.
It's amazing. That's awesome.
It's so easy to do. And then, unfortunately, I do have to whip out the USB cable and sync the videos over manually.
Yeah.
That's just getting the USB cable out. And it puts them right into the correct event, automatically. So I do that first, and then I sync the whole thing up to Flickr.
Jesus, that's great.
I upgraded my internet at home so I get 4 megabit up. So these things actually go pretty quick now.
Damn, that's awesome.
It's great, man. It is so awesome.
Yeah, I'm gonna set that up tomorrow.
All right, let's get to our next article. Interactive CSS3 lighting effects posted by Arlo Carrion.
It's cool.
Amazing demo.
Yeah, I mean, and it's so simple. It's so simple.
It's using 3D transforms. I've not seen this done before. Like, I know about CSS3's 3D transforms, but I haven't seen any. I don't know if this is a practical use case either, but I haven't seen any real use case of it being used. But what we're looking at right now is an iPad where, as you move your mouse around, it changes the orientation of the iPad, and then it has this great specular highlight that goes across the iPad as you move it, just like there's a spotlight in the top left of this.
That's not even a spotlight. It's more like a square kind of, office fluorescent.
Yeah, and that's kind of the downside of this, is that it's not really... The light itself has this hard boundary to it where it just kind of stops. I'm sure they could spend more time getting the style just right, but it's using a mask to basically stop that gradient, which is the lighting effect.
I'll tell you what, though, if I'm wiggling my finger over it, my CPU is going through the roof.
Is it?
Yep. All four of my cores are like at 50%.
Shit, I'm moving the mouse.
My fan
around.
Just kicked on, too.
Is it really, like, you're really moving this thing fast?
Yes.
Because I'm doing it with the mouse. I guess I can't get it to go fast, so my CPU is really not doing much at all. Are you in Chrome?
Yep.
Huh, interesting.
Are you in Chrome, too?
I am.
Interesting.
Yeah, CPU is really not getting pegged whatsoever. And I have Ustream going, and I'm recording, and
yeah.
I have 8 gigs on the computer, and I've maxed it out pretty much.
Yeah, I think I've got 8 gigs, too. What laptop are you running?
It's a MacBook Pro from this year, the one with the Sandy Bridge chipset.
Is it the i5?
They have lettering and numbering like that? I'm not even
sure. Yeah, so if you go up to your about, the Apple and then about this Mac.
Where is i5?
So when you say about this Mac, you got the processor, right? I've got the 2.3 gigahertz Intel Core i5.
Right, 2.2 gigahertz. Oh, Intel Core you're talking CPU. I thought you meant some kind of Apple model.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I totally blanked there. So, yeah, Core i7.
Okay, so yeah, I've got the i5.
Like, they don't really have a model number for MacBook Pros, It says 15-inch, early 2011. That's how they identify it.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's funny.
Okay, next article. Responding to responsive web design posted by Melanie Archer. I'm getting a little responsive web design fatigued. We talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
But what caught my eye for this article and why I want to mention it is that it started really saying we need to think outside the box, which, again, has become somewhat cliche with responsive design. And, we've talked about some articles like that in the past. But this guy really took it up a notch and said, we need to really think outside of, we've been doing responsive web design now since May of 2010. Wow, for a long time now. And he's saying that we, for this nearly, for this year and a half time period, we've really just been using it based on screen size to change the layout of a website. What else could we do that's responsive? And he came up with some crazy concepts here. He starts off by saying performance. So obviously not all of your devices have the same 3D or 2D performance capabilities. So maybe there are ways that you could try to figure out, how to, now that we have 3D transformations, maybe if the processor is fast enough, you can start integrating some 3D transformation stuff into your UI, but have it gracefully degrade. He's got in here quantity. So not just showing the images as smaller, like adaptively rendering the or supplying the image size based on the screen size, but looking at, okay, you want to be able to show two images here, maybe do 50% and 50% next to each other instead of just showing one image and not even showing the other one if, you're on a much smaller size screen. So again, that's kind of what responsive is today. But then he goes into behavior, and this was the one that really got me. As you use an app more and more, you become accustomed to it, you know your way around, maybe you don't need to see the text next to icons anymore. Mm-hmm. You've used it 20 times. So now responsive design means responsive to you being familiar with the app, not screen sizes anymore.
Yes.
That would blow my mind if an app literally changes its user interface the more I use it to allow me to have a more decluttered experience once I'm familiar with it. That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And it ties right into the next point of time. Right. I mean, the amount of time that I'm interacting with it, how familiar I am. So, no, I think a lot of these points are spot on. I mean, it's definitely a great read. I mean, I think the responsive nature, where we're all sick of the cliche and all that, it's very simple that when I go to your website, it needs to conform to the device that I'm looking at. It's very simple.
And not right? just, yeah, and that's just device screen size right now, but there are so many other
I mean, but even no, it needs to take into consideration the device. And now what he's doing is he's starting to give us examples of how we can really take advantage of that, really step it up a notch. You know, I think everybody agrees now that when I go to the website, I should have it experienced in the device form that I'm at. Now, yes, right now only people are really just squishing shit and make it fit on, you know, 320 wide. Mm-hmm. But the behaviors, the controls, again, we got to think we've got thumbs now and not mice, and you know, there's all sorts of things we can do. So that's what this article is really good at, is now saying, okay, we're done. We agree. Right. We know that it has to morph to the device. And so now here's the next level up of, let's start thinking about time and behavior and bandwidth and controls and quantity, you know?
The bandwidth one, I think, is key. If there's a way for your HTML5 app to check the bandwidth of your client,
mm-hmm.
and adapt, you know, maybe you're sending fewer images, maybe you really are altering the experience even further. I mean, there's a lot you could do to alter it so that if they're on an edge network or 3G network or 4G, or they're on Wi-Fi, you know, totally different user interfaces could be presented because of that.
Yeah. Is there a good way of detecting that?
I don't know. I'm interested to look into this stuff now. He really got the juices, you know, flowing for me. He's really like stirred it up. I'm like, shit, man, this is good. This is what needs to be done next. This is where it's going.
Yeah. And no, I agree. I think it's a great article.
The tone was interesting. If an author of a blog, if he tags an article as serious or comical, maybe it can actually change the style for that post, or change the theme of the website, or you know, you could.
Well, unfortunately, though, most designers are lazy.
Right.
Wait a minute. You mean I need to now have to take into consideration if it's a girl that the pink background has to match? Oh, no.
Actually, he left gender out of this, but that's an interesting point as well.
Oh, I think it's mentioned in here. That's where I got it.
Oh, the people?
Yeah, the people.
Oh, okay.
But to that point, though, right? I mean, they are. Designers are not developers. Designers have a tendency of, and I won't call them lazy, because what they're doing, you know, their whole creative aspect is totally different than what a developer's makeup is, where developers have a lot more patience. They you know, they're sitting there working on the plumbing, where the designer is more a little bit top level. And so I don't know. It will be interesting to see if people actually do this stuff. Other than big companies with huge, you know, with really good, not huge companies, hell, even, you know, what is it, 7 people work at Instagram?
Right.
Or something's crazy like that, you know, but most companies, like the majority, the 99%.
All right. Next article is full text search with MySQL, Rails 3, and Sphinx. This is posted by David Christensen. Very quick little article here, but I think it's important to show that it's really quick to do something like this. If you want to do full text search, especially in a Ruby on Rails app, it is incredibly quick and simple to do this using Sphinx or Solr or, you know, some external service. And you, Brandon, before the podcast, you were talking about how you've used Index Tank before, and now they're going away, right?
So I loved Index Tank. You know, I was like, oh my God, this is great. This is exactly what I need. And so when I started the new gig and I had to start building out this whole profile searching piece, I'm like, well, I'm just going to end up using Index Tank. And then I'm like, oh my God, they get bought by LinkedIn. And they say, well, you know, don't worry about us. We're going to be, you guys, we're going to support you for the next 6 months. It's like, well, shit. And so I do a post out there and I say, hey, anybody have any good alternative to Index Tank? And I got like almost no response whatsoever.
Huh.
And so now I've got to think about shit. Now I've got to actually think about, you know, search.
Do you know what was Index Tank using on the back end?
I don't know, honestly, but I do know that they're going to be open sourcing a lot of the stuff that they were doing.
Nice. Yeah, I went down this road earlier this year, about, you know, January, February of this year in, with Talonopoly. And I started off with Sphinx, and Craigslist uses Sphinx, and everybody says it's really fast. Really, it is a great search engine. I think it's a guy in Russia who does most of the programming, and it's written in C or C++, so nice, lean, fast search engine. And the so a few things that I ended up liking about it was that it could do spatial searching very easily with GPS coordinates, and that was nice, but I didn't like how it needed deltas, or not needed, but the standard way of doing it is that you do not re-index everything every time, like every 10 minutes or whatever your set interval is. Yeah. You just do a delta, and then like every couple of hours is when it gets rid of the deltas and does a full re-index. So you do have to set up some cron jobs to do that sort of stuff. Where when I looked at Solr, which is part of Lucene, that also can do the spatial, the GPS coordinates, which was a requirement for me. And at the time it was. Now, you know, it's not as much, but it will be again soon. So that you can search for people by location or jobs when we start having jobs on the website, things like that.
That's cool.
So, I'm always thinking about that. But with Solr, you don't have to worry about setting up any of those cron jobs. It doesn't do deltas. It seemed just as fast, at least for my, you know, I'm not dealing with the Craigslist sized files, you know, and data out there. So I'm not having to do millions and millions of records. So Solr seemed to perform just as well as Sphinx for me, and was actually even easier to set up. Very similar to what David has here in his listing, where when you look at what you have to do inside your model, you go, that's it. That's all I have to put in there. I just say indexes title, and now I can search on title. And yep, that's all you do. Like, I literally added search to several models in Talonopoly in under an hour, and it was fully working. It took more time to build the little HTML form and style that, way yeah. more time than adding any of the technical underpinnings to get the search to work.
Well, I'm going to check out Solr. I mean, it's come up a lot. There's a couple companies that are actually doing web-based. I think it's WebSolr they focus on kind of like what Index Tank did. So I'm at that point now where I'm going to have to make that decision here in the next couple weeks of which direction I'm going.
One of the local devs here I was having lunch with the other day, Aaron Lurch, he said he was using Index Tank as well. He was sad to see it going.
Yeah. And Reddit uses them for their search.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Hopefully this will be good news for WebSolr, because those guys do a kick-ass job, just like the Index Tanks guys. Mm-hmm. You can email support at any time of the day or night, and the guys who are the founders and the most knowledgeable are the ones also responding to the support emails, which Aaron was saying that Index Tank was like that. He actually had the founder replying to him on some things.
Yeah.
And same thing with WebSolr, and they're really easy to work with, and will point you in the right direction on how to do the config file if you need to do something special there and that sort of thing, exactly what version of the gem to use and whatnot.
That's cool.
And if you're using Heroku, it's an add-on, so it makes it even simpler. You don't even have to worry about your YAML file or anything. You just throw that add-on in there. I pay $20 a month for it. And I think it was up to 75,000 documents for $20 a month, and they just upped that number even higher. So
nice.
I would think that if you're indexing that much, you can probably afford $20 a month. You're driving value if you're searching that many.
Does Flickr allow you to embed the video that you upload?
Yes, but you can only play the first 90 seconds of your video, because they don't want to go nuts on the bandwidth for that. You can always download it again, but it's not meant as like a YouTube or a Vimeo.
Okay.
It's more of a personal archive.
Yeah.
But you could make a several gigabyte home video and put it up there. So I use it as a $25 a year hard drive for my videos, basically.
That's awesome.
For photos, I don't think there's any better way to view photos online. Flickr's done incredible stuff in JavaScript and CSS and just keeping the site very lean. So the load times, I think, beat anything else out there. And they will resize your image into all the different sizes so that if you're on the iPhone, you know, mobile experience is going to be small images, but you can always see all the sizes, including the original, and view any size you want.
I'm sold.
That's cool. I don't know why more people don't do it. It's such a steal. All right. Last article of the day. Top 10 CSS design resources posted by Nick Peelman. Thought we'd throw in some CSS stuff in here. give it a little love.
Yeah, it's good actually, and I embarrassingly completely missed this, but I agree with all of them. I mean, you have your W3C, to go and get all your drafts and get a validation.
Yep.
The web fonts, which is cool, whatever. And going back to that, which one I would include on here is that Pictos. Dean Wilson, I think is his name.
Drew
Wilson.
Yeah.
I love it. It's $49, so I finally paid it.
Super nice guy too. Easy to talk to on Twitter, and he actually does the ValleyOCon conference. Hopefully every year. He's putting the second one on in 2012.
Is this a man crush you have?
I don't think so. I think
a little bit
respect. I would call it for somebody who's
you call it respect. I call it man crush. No, whatever.
Well, this is what I have respect for. I like guys who are top of their game. You know, they're highly sought after, but still take the time to respond on Twitter or the time to just, if you meet them in person, to have just a really casual conversation with them. And even though the guy knows his CSS really, really well, Raji King will tweet him sometimes, asking him some tough CSS stuff, like things that you shouldn't even really do in CSS. And Drew's like, oh yeah, here's how you do it. Just the time that he takes to do that sort of stuff, I think, is really cool, and his time is so limited. So a lot of respect for that. I really like that in the design and developer communities, guys are easily approachable.
Cool.
Yeah.
sorry, I got stuck up in forme.org, F-O-R-M-E-E.org, and that's one of the things that came out of that CSS resource, which is just some nice-looking forms, and they're actually pretty damn good. It's got a grid system to it, and
I need to check that out. Yeah. I think just standard forms, if you leave it up to the browser, I don't really think they look that great unless, I think the new ones in Lion look a little bit better, but
but the default, definitely default. You need to put a little attention to your forms, because if you're not doing any CSS on your forms, it's going to look ghetto.
And I never really do.
I always do. I won't touch a form unless I'm modifying the fuck out of it.
That's awesome. I need to do more of that. CSS button maker. That looks interesting.
Yeah, no, that was the ultimate. Where's the button maker?
Second one from the bottom, right above for me.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. It's cool, drag and drop. I'm building a big, ugly CSS button, top gradient, colors, nice. Oh, and by the way, people, don't put your dark color on top.
Here's something I found interesting on Mixer-G the other day. I was listening to I forget which one it was, but it was basically like an A/B testing company. Mm-hmm. It was like TestWitch or something. And the woman who founded it was saying that they have found in A/B testing and with all their clients, like they've done so many A/B tests on this that they can really definitively say if there's any one thing to do to your button to try to increase conversion of like a sale button, a buy now or whatever, it doesn't matter what colors you choose. It doesn't matter what font you do. You can spend a lot of time designing it. The one thing that will make a difference is how freaking large it is. And she said, just do an A/B test of the most ridiculously large buy button versus your standard one right now, and she guarantees you'll get a much better conversion rate.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So this button maker here may look incredibly simple, and you're not going to create something that's going to get posted on Dribbble with this thing, but you don't need to spend that much time on it. Just make it big.
just make it ginormous.
Yes. And use this to make it and take 1 minute to do it and then laugh all the way to the bank.
Yeah. No, it's cool. That's a great tip.
I love that. You got me started on Mixer-G and I love it.
He's great, isn't he?
He is. He does love a good job. And, I like he's really humble and he seems approachable too. And he said that he had tried doing something like Mixer-G. He had kind of a false startup where he lost a decent amount of money trying to do it the first time around and learned a lot. And then, relaunched with the new Mixer-G and now it's doing really well. That's great.
You gotta get him on the show.
We should. That'd be awesome. Well, I think that's it for this week's podcast.
Excellent.
You can find us at Talentopoly on Twitter. We are on podcast.talentopoly.com. We have our RSS feed up there. We're also on Instacast and, of course, on iTunes. So hopefully you'll check us out. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.